As our traditional sources of energy deplete, there's certainly a need across the world for affordable energy that is sustainable. And we have a lot of great research going on right here at the University of Wisconsin to address that particular need. Really happy to have some folks from the Bioenergy Research Center. They come by the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center, I should say. John Greenler comes by every couple of months with another guest, and we talk about what's going on at the center, what you and I can expect to see coming from it, and also, and obviously talk about some new developments. Certainly nitrogen fertilizer isn't a new development. Nitrogen fertilizer has been on the scene for forever, pretty much. We're going to be talking, though, about it and how it's being used with bioenergy crops, because there's some research going on relating to it. So there are some opportunities and some challenges of using nitrogen fertilizer, and certainly John Greenler can talk about it, as can Brianna Lobby, who is a graduate student in Environment and Resources in the Nelson Institute for Environmental Studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. So they're both with me to talk about what's going on in that area. And certainly they're looking forward to what you have to say, too. How much do you know about the use of fertilizers and nitrogen fertilizers in particular? Certainly there's controversy associated with nitrogen fertilizers sometimes, and you may have questions about that. What about types of bioenergy crops that you may be interested in? Certainly, we'll have them updating what's going on with some of those plants. You may have some questions. I hope you'll join us. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org, or go to my Facebook page. You can post at the Larry Mueller Show, and we'd love to hear from you that way as well. And John Greenler, great to see you again.
Always good to be back. Thanks so much, Larry.
Yeah, appreciate it very much. And Brianna Lobby, thank you so much for coming by.
Thanks for having us.
I really appreciate both of you taking the time to talk about this. And, you know, here I am sitting here talking about bioenergy crops, and I didn't really define those. And I think we need to talk about what they are and how are they different from the other crops that we're talking about.
Sure.
Yeah, so bioenergy crops are crops that we're growing for energy, obviously. But in particular, we're looking at growing them for transportation fuel. And so right now in the U.S., the big one that most people have probably heard about is corn grain ethanol. But with the GLBRC, we're particularly looking at cellulosic ethanol. So that would be fuel from like the non-edible parts of the plant, like the leaves and the stems and the grasses.
And so that would include a broad range of plants then.
Right. So we're looking at everything from switchgrass, mix of grasses, as well as poplar trees, and corn stovers. So that would be the stems and the leaves of the corn plant, as opposed to the corn kernels.
Yeah, the stuff that's sitting out in the field primarily. Then.
Right, the stuff that's left over after harvest.
Yeah. And the ultimate uses for these bioenergy crops? Go in my gas tank? Or
there's a number of different options. I mean, you know, a simple version in terms of bioenergy is just take that biomass and burn it to generate heat for production of electricity or heat for, you know, for buildings. But more specifically, we're really interested in the potential to convert that cellulosic biomass into liquid transportation fuels. Because if you look at kind of our portfolio of energy, either nationally or globally, and our concerns about running out of oil and CO2 emissions, transportation is really kind of a crux area for us. So if we can take that biomass, grow it sustainably, and convert it into liquid fuels, not just gasoline, but also diesel and jet fuel, that's a very significant opportunity.
Yeah, I would certainly agree with that. Well, your work focuses on nitrogen fertilizer, using it for bioenergy crops. Maybe, you know, I think many people are certainly familiar with nitrogen fertilizer, but let's go back to the basics a little bit here. Tell us about nitrogen fertilizers and what they actually do.
Yeah, so one of the essential nutrients a plant needs to grow is nitrogen. So, you know, the nitrogen fertilizer gives them that boost and nutrient that they need to get growing each field season. So it's particularly used at the beginning of the season to get the plants growing.
So they use it for energy just to get underway, and probably also as the season goes on.
Yeah, so really it's not an energy source for the plant per se. That really comes from the sun through mm-hmm. the plant photosynthesizing, but it's really nitrogen as an element is really required as a kind of a backbone for the plant to be able to produce that biomass. It's critical for protein synthesis. It's in all proteins, DNA. You find nitrogen in all the compounds, many of the compounds which are really core to the material of a plant. All the enzymes which make the metabolism of a plant work are made up of proteins that need that nitrogen. So it's really mission critical that the plant have an adequate supply to be able to grow vigorously and fully.
And nitrogen fertilizers can come from leftover plants or that sort of thing, but also from commercial fertilizers. I think sometimes there's controversy surrounding that. And I don't know, Brianna, if you want to talk about that. Or
yeah, sure. So one of the problems, I mean, commercial fertilizer is great. It gives a huge amount of nitrogen to the plants in a quick dose. It's been great for increasing our productivity of food crops. But one of the problems is, there's a couple problems with it. One being in its production. To produce it, you have to use fossil fuels in order to just produce the fertilizer. So of course that's a release of greenhouse gas and a use of fuel. And then there are also problems just with overuse and the form of that the nitrogen is in when you add it makes it very easy for it to be lost from the crop. It makes it accessible to the plant, but it can also easily be lost to rivers and streams and things like that.
Yeah, eventually much of it makes its way down the Mississippi River to the Gulf of Mexico, where there's a very major issue called the hypoxic zone, where essentially it's a little bit complex in terms of the full system, but all that nitrogen essentially creates a oxygen-free area in the Gulf of Mexico, and nothing can live there. And it varies in size each year depending on how much rain we get up here in the Midwest, but it's, if we're looking at the size of Maryland or Delaware, it's a major area that essentially all the fish and et cetera just die every year, and it's wasted resource. So
and that's nitrogen primarily.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
And so obviously we've got to be careful with how we use it and what brought on your interest in looking at nitrogen for these particular bioenergy crops.
Yeah, well, I guess I'm particularly interested in land management and how a farmer would actually manage these bioenergy crops. And we're to expect that a farmer is going to want to fertilize. We want to produce more, and you want to make profit. So it's likely that they will be fertilized. But we're not sure exactly how much is necessary. We don't want to be adding too much. And we also want to know what the effects will be if we do fertilize. Are we having more detrimental effects than positive effects? Are these really worthwhile crops to be growing for those reasons?
So you're setting up research essentially to look at how nitrogen can be used or whether it's effective in use for these crops.
Yeah, so, I mean, how much and when is it best to apply that nitrogen? I mean, one of the significant opportunities, especially with some of these perennial crops that are being considered like switchgrass, is that they would need significantly less nitrogen to yield a lot of biomass per acre. But there's been so little research in these areas, we really don't know how much is needed to get a reasonable yield. How much is too much and begins to, leach the nitrogen out of the field, et cetera, into the waterways. And so this is really fundamental work that can both allow us to figure out, what some of these new crops may look like in terms of inputs versus outputs. And that's that net kind of gain is what's really important here in many cases, not just the, how many tons per acre, but how much do you need to put into that acre to get the equivalent amount of energy or biomass out is really what we need to look at very carefully.
So how to make it pay environmentally.
Right.
Environmentally and economically, yeah. Really look at that balance, that sweet spot.
Yeah, and I guess just to add to that, another thing that we're looking at, other than nitrogen leaching into groundwater and other waterways, is nitrous oxide emissions. Mm-hmm. So if there's too much nitrogen in the soil and the plant hasn't used it all up, it can be released out of the soil as the greenhouse gas nitrous oxide. There's not a lot of nitrous oxide in the atmosphere, but it is 300 times more potent than carbon dioxide as far as global warming. It traps that heat 300 times better than carbon dioxide. So if we add too much fertilizer, it could be that we're releasing more greenhouse gases than we really want to be.
Very interesting. We'll talk some more here with our two guests today, Brianna Labbe and John Greenler. I'm interested in looking and knowing how they're actually going about measuring and researching this, and that'll be part of our conversation right after we take a look at the news here on the Ideas Network. Well, many of us enjoy lots of time in the outdoors. We actually think about a lot of things, and I think as you look at those fields of corn and those fields of maybe switchgrass someday out there, there's going to be some crops that are going to provide maybe some affordable, sustainable energy for us. So there's a lot of work going on at the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center to tell us about new developments in the search for cleaner and safer renewable energy. John Greenler brings a different researcher each time to talk with us. Today, Brianna Labbe is with him to talk about her work on nitrogen fertilizers and bioenergy crops. You may have some questions. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234, and we'll be back with our guests right after this look at the news. Stay with us. Well, as a country and the planet, for that matter, we still use predominantly more traditional forms of fuel. There's a lot of exciting research going on to move us toward cleaner and more renewable sources. And some of that cutting-edge work is happening right here at the University of Wisconsin. Larry Mueller here. We're talking about that a bit today and is focusing a little bit on bioenergy crops, some of the opportunities and challenges of nitrogen fertilizer use in connection with those crops. Certainly looking forward to hearing what you have to say, your questions and comments. How much do you know about the use of fertilizers and nitrogen fertilizers in particular? And what types of bioenergy crops might you be interested in? Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org. Or go to my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. You can post a question or a comment there as we visit with John Greenler. John directs education and outreach programs for the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center. Thanks, John, for coming by again.
A pleasure.
And Brianna Labbe, also with us today, graduate student in Environment and Resources in the Nelson Institute for Environmental Studies at UW-Madison. Brianna, thanks for coming by.
Happy to be here.
Really appreciate it very much. Again, you might have a question or comment. Join us at 1-800-642-1234 as we visit with our experts here. And Valerie in Green Bay has been waiting a little while, so let's give her a chance. Val, thank you for calling. Hi.
Good morning.
Morning.
We recently moved. I'm in my 70s, and I've been gardening since my 20s.
Yeah.
And living in the Green Bay area, and we recently moved here from Manitowoc. So the two invasive species that I see that are sucking up nitrogen and could be sources, if anybody's looking at it, I would like to know. And one of them is the algaes that are in our lakes.
Yep.
They roll in huge rolls coming up. Lake Michigan and the Wisconsin lakes are full. And I'm wondering if that could be a source for something, because they already are using nitrogen that is too abundant and going into the lakes. And
yeah.
The other one is the canary reedgrass and the Phragmites, which we call it quackgrass on steroids because it just grows Amazing.
So Reed's canary grass and Phragmites, those are, well, let's turn to John first, John.
I'd love to hear.
Yeah, thanks.
Sure. Yeah, and those are some really interesting examples to bring up, because invasive species are something we need to be, you know, very considerate about when we think about our ecosystems and the environment. You know, with the algae, frequently, you know, we can put that into the category of kind of being a residue material. There's all sorts of biological material that's out there that is, you know, either a waste product or very low value. And especially in situations where there may already be, you know, cleanup projects underway, that material is essentially being removed and piled up, kind of goes into the category of being a bit of an urban residue. And there's no reason why that can't be, you know, it's seen as being an opportunity. It's a cellulose-based material. And as we look towards the future, it's definitely, you know, of value. The trick is that if we have to harvest it for that purpose, we have to look at how much energy it would take to harvest it, and are we going to get more energy out than we're putting in to actually collect that material? But it's already being collected, like here in the Madison area, for example. There's a lot of lakeweed removal projects already underway. And, you know, if that's the case, we should be able to, as we develop the technology, be able to convert that material from cellulose to sugars, and then from sugars any number of different kinds of fuel, like ethanol or diesel-like fuels as well.
And, you know, and Nancy in a Facebook question has asked about the lake grasses. And
right.
From somebody who lived on Lake Monona, you know, I've watched those grasses be collected, and those lake weeds. And you get a pretty big pile of lake weeds, but once they're dried, it's like, there's nothing
kind of
left.
Shrivels down and not much, right. And that is an issue. It's very impressive how much material we really need of this variety to make a difference. So, for example, some years back, about 5 years ago now, there was a large study sponsored federally to look at how much cellulosic material, how much of this fibrous, you know, non-edible material is there out there that we could sustainably harvest. Ends up being about 1.3 billion tons per year. And that would, you know, if we could effectively tap into that, we could probably replace about a third of our nation's transportation fuel by using all of that fibrous cellulosic material. So we really need to look, you know, in all the corners, but it's not trivial to kind of collect all that and be able to convert it into fuels.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Val, for calling. Appreciate it. I want to give Linda and Lac de Flambeau a chance to join in. Linda, hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I have kind of a side question. I have a friend who, rather than using salt, he uses nitrogen on his decks and ramps and walkways, thinking that's probably a better choice. And I'm wondering what you thought about doing that.
Ooh, I don't think that's a very good choice. Brianna, you want to talk about that?
Yeah, I've never heard of that before, but, I mean, there are definitely problems with using salt on roads. It can definitely impact the plants growing near on those roadsides. There are, of course, salt-tolerant plants that can be used. Nitrogen does not seem like the best option. Like we said, it can be easily lost from this, like, the ecosystem. So we already have problems with too many nutrients in our waterways. So I would think that adding more for that kind of purpose is probably not the best idea.
No, not at all, John.
I've never seen a study on that. I can imagine that it might work because it's going to lower that melting point. But I think, it, you know, at what cost? And I've never seen a direct environmental study of that. But I think Brianna's assessment is a very good one.
Well, and frankly, even just if you look at the cost, out-of-pocket cost, right. Nitrogen is a whole lot more expensive.
Definitely. It takes a lot of energy, as Brianna was saying earlier, to make that nitrogen fertilizer. So, yeah, I think it's not going to be a cost-effective option as well.
No. So tell that person, Linda, that he should cease and desist from that.
I will certainly do that. I'll tell him I got it from the expert.
Interesting question. Thank you.
It's just going to wind up in the lake or the river, and it's going to be feeding those plants that we don't want.
Exactly.
Tom in West Bend, hello.
Hey, how are you?
Great. Thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Good. I was wondering, I saw a program, I believe, that they're using cow manure and stuff to make energy through a generator. and supplying people with electricity that lived around them. I think it was like a program where they helped pay for the to make the generator and stuff like that, and then they get electricity back from it. And I was just wondering, in the future, is there anything that would work for, you know, like mound systems or holding tanks, so people could use that for energy for their own homes? Or am I way out of the ballpark?
No, you're not out of the ballpark at all. And in fact, Wisconsin is really a leader in this area nationally. Clearly, we have a lot of cows and therefore a lot of cow manure. And you're right on track. There's by anaerobically digesting that manure, you can produce a lot of methane, and you can do a number of different things with it. I mean, most of what is being looked at here in Wisconsin is to be able to use that methane on site locally, essentially, to be able to generate electricity. And we have farmers and co-ops of farmers, essentially, that are pooling their manure as a resource to do exactly this. So it's definitely something which we're seeing in Wisconsin. It's significant locally. Nationally, it's not going to put a huge dent in our energy demands, but we need to look at all resources. And when you look internationally, for example, it's very interesting what's being done in Germany. They also have a very big dairy industry, and they're really taking full advantage of their manure. In many cases, they're actually mixing it in with other urban residues to produce a lot of methane. Some of it goes to generate electricity, but they're also have developed technologies to actually be able to clean up that methane gas and actually be able to pipe it out, much the way, you know, we use gas for home heating and our ranges and whatever as well. So there's a lot of potential there that we're really just beginning to take advantage of. So.
Yeah, I was thinking immediately of the Crave brothers, Farb, who I've interviewed those fellows, and you might, Tom, if you go online, just Crave, Crave Farms is one example of a farm where they're really making good use of that and providing electricity for a lot of homes.
Yeah, excellent reference.
Plus all their own.
Yeah, do they have anything as far as, can we make enough methane off our own holding tanks and mound systems for something like that too, or not?
In this country, I mean, there are a number of kind of health and safety issues, which I think are concerns along those fronts. But I can tell you at the same time that, once again, if you look globally, there's some very interesting projects exactly along those lines in developing countries where human waste, is a significant source of starting material for exactly what you're talking about. In some cases, it might be to generate electricity. In many cases, actually, they're tapping into the resulting gas for home heating and cooking on a very small, local, but sustainable scale. Mm. So a lot of interesting stories along those fronts.
Yeah. Thanks, Tom.
Well, thank you.
Appreciate it very much. We have Frank in Brownsville next. Hi, Frank. Thank you for calling.
Hello. Say, I've got a question on biodiesel fuel.
Okay.
Is it true that biodiesel fuel collects water or moisture?
I'm going to answer that question somewhat indirectly, and I think it really, you know, it should have properties very similar to regular diesel. By the time they've converted those vegetable oils, etc., into a fuel source, I think in terms of those chemical properties, there are some issues, for example, of when a fuel might solidify that I know are of a concern in terms of biodiesels, and I think they've largely been able to address those. But I haven't heard that as being a significant issue in terms of biodiesel.
You know, when it gets into your system, into your fuel system, a system, and you have to, you know, take out the water out of the out of that whole collection thing. Mm-hmm. Oh, it's just it'll cost you money.
Right. Yeah. I can believe that.
Thanks for calling. I appreciate your call, Frank. We had an email from Donald who's wondering, assuming the proposed use of the switchgrass is for biofuel, what thoughts have you at the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center given to the carbon dioxide emissions when switchgrass is burned in an electric power plant? Have they considered proposals for a carbon tax on those emissions? And, let's turn to Brianna for that. Brianna?
Yeah, so we're not particularly looking at switchgrass being burned for power. Instead, we're looking at converting it into an ethanol as a transportation fuel. But still on that note, we are looking at the effects of growing these crops, really at the whole life cycle of producing switchgrass or biofuel and the effects that has on carbon dioxide emissions. The overall hope is that because switchgrass is a plant, it's taking in carbon dioxide from the air, and hopefully it's taking in more carbon dioxide than it gives off when you burn it in your car. So that's definitely something we're looking at, not exactly in the burning sense, but we are definitely focusing on that.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that's not obvious from our above-ground view with switchgrass, but which is really significant, is that it's a perennial. And it's a prairie perennial, so it has very deep roots. I mean, the roots of switchgrass are three or four times or more further down than the plant grows up. And that below-ground biomass continues to build. So we're talking about harvesting the above-ground biomass to make a fuel, but at the same time, we're actually putting a lot of carbon in the ground that has come from the atmosphere. So, you know, the analyses that have been done have actually showed that if we do it right, we actually may have a carbon negative energy source when we look at some of these perennial crops like switchgrass. We may be actually on a net balance be putting, you know, locking more CO2 out of the atmosphere underground than we're actually re-emitting back into the atmosphere from the combustion of that above ground material. So that's a very exciting aspect of these perennial crops.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, when you talk about, you know, we were visiting about a nitrogen use on these crops, what kind of research, Brianna, are you doing? Are you working with a monoculture like switchgrass? Are you working with other grasses?
Yeah, so I'm focusing on a range of grasses. I'm looking at the monoculture switchgrass, so just pure switchgrass stands, as well as a diverse native grass system, which has about five different prairie grasses mixed together, and then also a native prairie system. So that would include those same grasses as well as some forbs or broadleaf flowering plants.
Mm-hmm.
I'm looking at how those ranges of diversity affect nitrogen losses. So if you have a more diverse system, do you lose less nitrogen into your groundwater? Do you reduce nitrous oxide emissions? Or does diversity not really play a role in that?
Yeah. You'd think diversity could play a role. You get a drought situation, for example. I would think if you had some plants that were a little more drought tolerant than others.
Yeah, it's definitely thought that more diverse systems will be able to better use nitrogen. You know, if you have five different grasses, they can all use nitrogen from different sources. If you just have one grass like switchgrass, it can only access one type of nitrogen from one place.
Mm-hmm.
That's putting it kind of basically, but that's more or less the idea. So if it's more diverse, you can use up more of that nitrogen from the soil, and so you're leaving less there to be lost. Mm-hmm.
And that really, to chime in briefly, weaves in with a whole diversity of benefits of having these diverse systems. I mean, you know, more efficiency with nitrogen is one of a number of different dimensions. It also, having a diverse planting also means a lot more habitat for insects and birds, for example, which bring a lot of direct benefits in multiple dimensions, including, direct practices in terms of farming, in terms of, beneficial insects that can help us take care of pest problems, for example. So there are all sorts of things that we gain when we move towards these polycultures, these diverse plantings.
Matt in Liberty Pole, we'll give you a chance now. Thanks for calling. Hi.
Hi. I'm a part-time organic farmer, and I've heard a bit of material about this subject. And things like corn stover and soybean residues are often referred to as waste. And it concerns me because I know that anything I leave on my fields going to break down and contribute to the organic matter in that soil, and I'm just wondering if that's being taken into the equation here, the long-term health of soil.
Yeah, both of our guests are shaking their heads yes. Brianna?
Yeah, that's an excellent point. That's very, very important. You're exactly right. Often it's looked at as waste, and it's definitely not. There's a lot of organic matter in that corn stover. That's really best left on the field. The more nutrients you take out by removing that corn stover, the less there is for the next year and for building soil health. So we are definitely taking that into account. And it's another reason why these perennial grasses are a better option. You harvest them and there's still a lot. They have a, like John said, they keep a lot of their nutrients in their roots and they build up the soil organic matter in that way. So yeah, we are looking at, we have a study going on too that's looking at corn and whether we leave the corn stover on the field and whether we remove it and what are the effects on the soil when we do that. So great point. We're definitely looking into that too.
Yep. You know, one of the things we're finding, in fact, is in some cases, if we are going to be removing corn stover, it's very clear that a better alternative may be to plant a cover crop. And so we are looking at some of these systems to diversify our agricultural practices by having multiple crops that might be growing during different times in the season. So really trying to kind of consider all these options, because maintaining soil health, good organic matter is really critical. And this is part of the reason why I think I frequently refer to corn stover as being a residue material, not a waste material, because it is of significant value to farmers in terms of managing their soil. So, excellent. Yeah.
Thanks very much, Matt. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
And, you know, when you think about corn, you know, we always talk about that's kind of the corn stover. Well, that's the first generation of all this. And really, I'm suspecting that it won't be that many years before we're not talking so much about corn anymore.
Yeah, so I mean, you know, just kind of looking at where the industry is right now, kind of as a snapshot, you're exactly right, Larry. I mean, there are a number of commercial scale plants that are under construction at this point in time to produce cellulosic biofuels from corn stover. There also are some plants that are going up that are looking more at woody residue materials, and we haven't talked as much about this, but if you go up into the northern part of our state, for example, there's a lot of forestry practices where there is material that can be removed sustainably, and if you go out into the western part of our country, down in the southeast, for example, there frequently are large amounts of woody materials. And then we really begin to diversify out from there. I think we're not too far behind from being able to see the technology necessary to work with, you know, with switchgrass, for example, and related other grass-like materials. So it's really moving along. And I think, you know, first steps are not as diverse, but we're really seeing increasing opportunities to diversify what we can use.
How many? How long has your research been ongoing, Brianna? And what's the sort of a timeline for you for your work?
Yeah, so I started doing the actual in-field research in 2011 for that field season, and then continued it through this past summer as well. So I'm actually going through data right now, and hopefully we'll have some results by the spring.
Excellent.
Yep, and her work is part of some long-term ongoing research that we have both at the Arlington Research Station just north of Madison and then also actually at the Kellogg Biological Station in Michigan outside of Kalamazoo. So, you know, we're looking at least a 10-year timeline to look at this kind of data, because you really don't get the big picture perspective until you have many, many growing seasons of data. So we're really looking forward to Brianna's data and then just kind of continue to see how things develop.
And, you know, I love the fact that we have it's a great opportunity for our graduate students to gain a lot of in-the-field research that is going to help society and certainly help them advance their own careers.
Definitely.
Thank you so much, John and Brianna. Appreciate it very much. Our guest today, John Greenler, directs education and outreach programs for the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center, and Brianna Lobby is a grad student in environment and resources in the Nelson Institute for Environmental Studies at the UW-Madison, and great to have them along. And you know what? It was great to have you listening in too today. Thank you so much for listening, and please stay with us. Lots in store here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.